Welcome to RN First Bite, I'm Michael McKenzie. If you and I were living in 18th century London, there was a liquid that we could drink that cured gout, it prevented indigestion, and it was so cheap we could quaff it until we lost the ability to swallow. Workers got paid with it, children and houses were sold for it, and it was drunk with such abandon it made men impotent and women sterile. It was one of the reasons why the population plummeted in the English capital for a while.
Gin was the crack cocaine of the 1800s. I mean, it just about destroyed a nation, strangely enough. It's got this very strange rollercoaster history.
Gin, the opium of the people. Londoners drank 10 million gallons of it a year because the government hardly taxed it. No wonder some of the names it went by were Cuckold's Comfort, Lady's Delight and Knock Me Down. Two centuries on and a hemisphere away, I'm visiting a distillery on the outskirts of Melbourne. It's one of the few in Australia dedicated to making craft gin, but government excise still plays a role.
We have to have a sort of caged Hannibal Lecter-style area. So as soon as it leaves this area, I pay the tax within a week.
Actually. Every week?
Every Monday.
So if we stay in this area and drink in this area, we're not going to be taxed on the gin we drink.
Actually, I hadn't even thought about it like that. They might weigh you on the way out the door. Do it on consumption.
Bring it on.
It's cleaner than water. It's cheaper than porter. It's gin. It helps you get through all that life throws at you. Gin!
We're not related, are we?
No, I don't think so. Well, I mean, we own most of the Highlands.
That's exactly right. We'll get rid of those McDonald's one day.
Yeah.
Cameron McKenzie's my name, and I'm the distiller and one of the directors for Four Pillars Gin. We're based out here in Warrandyte, right on the Melbourne edge of the Yarra Valley.
What distinguishes the craft gin you produce and what I can buy at any liquor store down the street?
Yeah, look, I guess it's not dissimilar to beer and wine in many respects, and craft spirits is just starting to happen in Australia. It's already gone crazy in the UK and the US. What we're talking about here is we don't have a continuous still. That style is kind of sausage factory spirits production. What we wanted to do was do small batch handcrafted spirits that we don't mind if the batches have some really subtle differences all the way through. Botanicals will change throughout the year.
What botanicals are.
Well, the botanicals are the flavourings in our product. And gin, the main rule for gin is you have to have juniper berries.
Why?
Well, that was the basic flavouring going right back to when the Dutch made Geneva or Genever.
Which is where gin gets its name from.
Exactly right, yes.
There's London gin, slow gin, there's distilled gin, then there's just gin. So what characterises all these different names for gin?
Yeah, London Dry is probably the most widely distributed gin and probably the most well-known gin going around. And that's a really juniper-dominant style of gin, really aromatic, but highly sort of pine needles and citrus, if you like.
Why London? Is that where it originated from?
Well, it started obviously with the Dutch and then quickly moved over to the UK. And the UK, I guess, kind of hijacked something that was made originally by the Dutch. And, you know, slow gin is a gin that is then steeped in slow berries, which is like a small plum. Old Tom gin is one that we're working on here as well, which is a barrel-aged gin.
And Old Tom? Where?
Tom was basically a picture of a black cat on a building that was selling bootleg gin. And this originated in the UK as well. Old Tom's then almost got hijacked by the Americans pre-Prohibition and became a much more handcrafted product and a much more refined product. And we're a classic cocktail ingredient. We saw some last year in the US that were extraordinary and we thought, no, we really, really want to make one of those.
I'll fight the Army Navy, yes, me and my gin.
Recorded in 1928 in the midst of American Prohibition, renowned blues singer Bessie Smith with Me and My Gin. And the spirit she was coveting would have been distilled using the same techniques employed by Cameron McKenzie in 21st century Australia. Perhaps Bessie even drank gin from the same brand of still.
Oh, the good old bottle of gin, we'll get it all the time.
This incredible stainless steel and copper apparatus that stretches up to the ceiling and looks like it's from about 1865. Tell us the story behind this, because I think Carl, the manufacturer, have a very long and reputable history.
All the guys I really liked in the US were using a Carl still. Was certainly the most expensive of all the stills. This is the reason I'll homeschool my kids, I suspect. It's a really beautiful still, and all the gins I liked in the US were out of Carl stills. So,
what makes it so special?
It's beautifully engineered. The Germans know what they're doing. Carl have been making stills for over 100 years. They only make maybe 25 to 30 of these a year. They hand make everything, and it's a really beautiful still. Her name is Wilma. She's named after my late mother, who was quite beautiful, I might say. But my mum, I'm the youngest of five boys, so it's fair to say she could get pretty hot under the collar as well. So we felt it was a really appropriate tribute to her. So Wilma sits here in Warrandyte. She's a 450-litre copper pot still with a swan's neck that extends out the top here.
It looks like an old gramophone trumpet turned upside down, actually.
This copper, the use of copper, is just makes these such a work of art.
Does the copper actually add to the flavour of the gin?
Copper reacts with spirit and removes sulfides. It's obviously very good to hold heat, and we need to hold heat through this process, and it also helps clean the botanicals on the way through. But it definitely does react with spirit. It softens the spirit and makes the spirit much, much cleaner all the way through.
The spirit Cameron McKenzie is talking about is the 450 litres of neutral grain spirit that goes into every batch of gin that Wilma makes.
So the first vapours to come off, or spirits as they used to be called, will be a much higher concentration of alcohol. And that's all vodka is. Vodka is just unfinished gin in my eyes.
450 litres goes in, about 130 litres comes out, having gone through heating and condensing across plates and through pipes. But it's not as simple as that. It took Cameron 18 months of testing, tasting and smelling flavours before he and his team had a combination of botanicals they were really happy with.
We wrote down modern Australia, what is modern Australia, and we didn't want kangaroos and wombats. We looked at a lot of menus, we spoke to a few chefs, so we narrowed down our botanicals to basically include the spices of Southeast Asia right through to the Middle East, but start with juniper. Juniper's very, really fresh pine needles. You know,
Reminds me of oil paint.
Yep,
I can smell that.
Absolutely. And on its own, you know, it needs flavourings with it.
So they're from Macedonia, are they? And Greece?
They're Macedonia and Italy.
Italy.
This is coriander, and this is from India. Now, this is Tasmanian pepperberry leaf, lemon myrtle. Cardamom, that's from Guatemala, and angelica root is quite an earthy, bitter substance. It's related to dill and parsley.
So this is the fixative. This is the one that keeps the botanicals within the flavour molecules of the spirit.
Yeah, I mean, alcohol's a fixative too, but this does exactly that, but it's also a bittering agent.
Yes.
The second last one is lavender, so if anyone's a lavender grower, give me a call. Our final one that was sort of, I guess, the icing on the cake for us was the use of fresh oranges in our botanical basket.
And not just orange peel, which is often used as a botanical flavouring, but whole oranges, so the inside as well.
We use biodynamic oranges. We don't want any wax on the orange. And we use the whole orange. We just cut it in half, and we sort of sit them gently into the botanical basket. So they're like little cups, if you like. And you haven't lived until you've eaten an orange that's been steamed in gin for 6 hours.
Does it blow your head off?
Well, there's no alcohol left, but at the end of the distillation, they retain all their sugar and their acids. So they're actually, you're like eating a really warm, beautiful cooked orange, but it's picked up all of these botanical flavours. We've made some marmalade with them. You know, I'm making some orange bitters with them, and they're just extraordinary. So you better taste some gin.
All right. Okay, then. Sure. But I wanted to do this properly, so I left Cameron behind at the distillery and travelled into the centre of Melbourne, where I entered the Gin Palace. And I met a bartender and gin specialist, Trish Brew. Yes, that really is her last name.
Consumers more than ever are starting to realise that there are really good quality products out there. And it's not a matter of having the cheapest, you know, gin on the market anymore. People are really, really caring about what they're putting into their mouths, which is great.
Can we try a little something here? Can you make something happen in that glass and show me your techniques at work?
We're going to use some salted kumquats that my boss Vernon has picked from his trees in the Yarra Valley, actually, which is where Four Pillars is currently being made. So fancy that.
Salted kumquats.
It tastes like marmalade. It's absolutely gorgeous. Rattling around here.
So Trisha's got a beautiful long-handled silver spoon to ladle the salted kumquats from the rather fetching plastic tray into the, into the burgundy glass. Now,
absolutely.
Here comes the gin.
We're going 50 mils of that.
And how much salted kumquats in that glass?
Oh, I would say about 6 or 7 would be nice. We're going to pop some ice in there.
Now, if my boss doesn't happen to have a kumquat tree in his backyard, where can you source salted kumquat?
Firstly, that's a shame.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's fruit stores at the moment that would be selling them, specialty fruit stores.
Season, it's in season, that's right, yeah.
We're going to use that beautiful Fever Tree Mediterranean tonic we just talked about. It's less bitter, it's nice and light. You'll definitely be able to taste the gin. Quite a good splash of that, but not too much because you still want to taste that beautiful gin.
Trisha's delving into various cold boxes to look for the right thing.
Well, here's one I prepared earlier.
Here's one. Oh, yeah.
Nice big piece of red grapefruit and some star anise.
Ah, well, because I've talked to Cameron about this.
Yes, very aromatic. They use star anise, and grapefruit goes perfectly with their gin. And voila, there we go. Just pop that on top for an aromatic effect.
How many times a week are you making that kind of drink for customers over the bar here?
We're making them daily, quite a lot, quite a lot of them. What, now for the taste test, Michael, why don't you have a taste and see what you think?
Oh, look, if you insist. Thank you. It's enormous. I can feel my bicep bulging just to bring the glass up to me. That is really quite lovely, isn't it?
Excellent. You know, gin and tonic is a drink that stood the test of time. You know, first it was there for medicinal purposes. Now it's just quite a nice sipper. And, I mean, why stick to your standard? Make it fancy. You're a gin palace. You can have a gin anywhere in the world.
Gin is the tonic to cure all your woes. Gin is the tonic to cure all your woes.
Bartender and gin specialist Trish Brew. And before her, boutique gin producer Cameron McKenzie. You're listening to RN First Bite, Michael McKenzie here. My next guest spent the first part of her life saving house guests from being poisoned by her mother, and the second part of her life saving whole cities from being poisoned by professionals. In between, Ruth Reichel worked in kitchens of communal restaurants before falling into writing restaurant reviews for the New York and Los Angeles Times, then memoirs of food and family, editing the 70-year-old US magazine Gourmet before it closed, and has just published her first novel, called Delicious. On top of all that, Ruth is clearly a multi-talented actress, perhaps even the food industry's answer to Meryl Streep, which we'll talk more of in a moment. She's grimacing as I say that. Ruth is in Australia as a guest of the Melbourne Writers' Festival. And Ruth, I don't want to ask you about your first ever food review. I'd like you to tell me about your second.
Okay, my second review. I mean, I was trying to get the job. And I did the first one, and they said, okay, you know, this is good, but you better do another one. And, you know, I was living basically in a commune in Berkeley, and I was not thinking, oh, I really want this job because I want to be a restaurant critic. I was thinking, I'm going to get free meals, and
yes,
what a fantastic thing.
And you come from a writing family as well.
I do. And so I, you know, told all my roommates that we were going out for this fancy meal. And, of course, they all really wanted me to get the job, too, because they wanted those free meals. And we got to the restaurant, and I have learned since then that you don't ask people to help you. But I didn't know that then. So they're all desperately giving me advice.
How many people did you have around the table?
There were 6 of us. And while this is happening, I just have, you know, one of these moments, which you sometimes have if you're lucky as a writer, and I see us as a band that has been sent by a rival restaurateur to find fault with this restaurant.
Yes.
And I go home, and in this blaze of inspiration, I write this little piece that begins, "The names have all been changed to protect the innocent." And I give them, each of them, you know, Fingers, Rosie, The Mouth. They all have sort of cops and robbers' names.
Sort of film noir.
It's a film noir script with the food is kind of woven through it, but it's not in any sense a conventional review. And I go to sleep, and I get up in the morning, and I look at it, and I really think it's pretty brilliant. And I go back to San Francisco and throw it on my editor's desk. And then I get back in my car and drive back to Berkeley, back across the Bay Bridge. And on the bridge, it suddenly hits me that I have made a terrible mistake. I mean, what was I thinking? This is not a review. This is a dopey little short story, which I have called Cops and Robert. And I'm on the middle of the bridge, so I can't do anything. And of course, this is before cell phones. So I get off the bridge. I take all my coins and throw them into a phone booth and call my editor and say, John, don't read that. Don't read that. I've picked up the wrong piece. And he says, it's too late. And my heart just sinks. And he's a little bit of a sadist, so he sits there for a minute and says nothing. And then he says, this is fantastic. This is just what we want. American restaurants are growing and changing, and the writing about them should change too. But he gave me license to write reviews that were, I'm sure, the weirdest reviews ever written. And so when I got to the LA Times, I didn't know that I couldn't write those kind of reviews. My editor said, Ruth, we really have to talk. And I said, okay. And he said, this is a newspaper. And I said, I know it's a newspaper. And he said, you can't make stuff up. And I suddenly thought, what am I going to do? I don't want to write restaurant reviews that are just consumer reports. I don't want to write, eat this, don't eat that, how to spend your money. I have to figure out something else to do. And it was a real aha moment for me where I started thinking about what is a restaurant review and how do you do this in a way that is fair, journalistic, but also really interesting.
So I should explain to people why I called you the Meryl Streep of the food industry, because in flying out to New York to begin your new life at the New York Times as a food reviewer, food critic, you discovered on the plane that you were sitting next to a woman in the New York restaurant industry who already knew who you were, and your photo was up like an FBI most wanted list on restaurants around New York. So you had to invent characters to go in disguise review.
I was shocked. I mean, in L.A., they hadn't cared. You know, in L.A., they care where the celebrities go much more than where the critics go. In New York, I mean, I was just shocked to discover that I had these big wanted posters in every in every restaurant. And I just sat on that plane fretting and thinking, I can't do this. I cannot go out and be, you know, have everybody roll out the red carpet. And it's not fair because that's not what happens to the people who are reading it. And so I thought, okay, if they know who I am, I'm going to be someone else.
You were a whole range of characters.
I did. And I called my mother's best friend, who was an acting coach, and said, where do I buy a wig? And Claudia said, oh, no, 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 no. If you think you're just going to put on a wig and a pair of funny glasses and that's going to do, you're crazy. She said, you know, you can't make a fool of yourself. You're going to be the restaurant critic of the New York Times. You have to do this properly. And she forced me to literally create characters and know the backstories. You know, who is this woman? Where does she live? What does her family do? Mm. And they each had not only their own credit cards and their own clothing and, of course, their own wig, but their own jewelry. And some of them had nails, which I do not have. And
their own state of mind.
And their own state of mind.
Which is why I call you an actress, yeah. Because clearly in the way you write about inhabiting that character, you truly, in front of friends and intimates, became another person.
Well, the thing that was great about that was when I went to write fiction, what I said to my editor was, I'm not sure I can write fiction. And she said to me, oh, come on, Ruth. You've been living fiction for the last 6 years. If you can create Chloe. Chloe was the sultry blonde who actually picked up guys in bars. I mean, she was...
Did she just?
She did. She did.
Did you write about that as well?
I did.
Did you review them?
I didn't review the guys, no. But I'll tell you, there is no better disguise than being with someone who literally does not know that you're the person you're pretending to be. I mean, it is a perfect disguise.
So did you actually pick up guys and go and eat with them at restaurants you were reviewing?
I did. My husband was not real happy about this, may I say. But I would, in fancy restaurants, I would sometimes go, Chloe would go and sit at the bar. drinking a martini and chat up the guy next to her.
So that role-playing helped you in writing Delicious. This is the first novel of yours that came out earlier this year, featuring a young woman you call Billy.
It really helped because I realized, okay, if I can do this in person, I can certainly do it on the page. I can imagine myself into another character. And so my editor said to me, well, who do you want to be? And I said, 21.
And that's how the character was born.
And that's how Billy was born.
Billy was born.
I thought, I want to be 21. I want to be just discovering New York because I love New York. And so this is, you know, Delicious is partly a love letter to New York. I want to be discovering all the food of New York. And I wish I had a perfect palate. So I'm going to give her that ability to literally taste something and instantly know not only what it is, but how to get that flavor, how to mix those flavors.
My guest is Ruth Reichel, who has been a food critic for much of her working life. One of the characters, and you've played a number to get those reviews done for New York Times back in the 90s, were Chloe, Emma, who revealed some of the worst sides of yourself. You also played your mother. And as someone who's written extensively about life with your mother and family life and food, you called her the Queen of Mold at one stage. What was it like to take on characteristics of a person who you dearly loved but in some part didn't really want to be?
It was terrifying. I mean, becoming my mother, I didn't know that I looked like her. And suddenly, I had this silver short wig on and I was wearing her clothes and her jewelry, and I looked in the mirror, and I literally was my mother. I mean, I sent a photograph of myself dressed like that to my brother, who said, I've never seen that photograph of Mom. But my mother was the nightmare restaurant goer. She sent everything back. Nothing, I mean, I, in contrast, never send anything back.
But you will write the truth about it later.
I will write the truth about it later, which gives me, I guess I don't need to send it back. But, you know, being with her was really cringe-making because martinis weren't cold enough, soup wasn't hot enough. There was always a problem. And becoming her, two things happened. One, I found myself literally behaving the way that she did in a way that horrified me. I mean, suddenly I'm saying, you call this a Caesar salad? This restaurant used to make a perfectly wonderful Caesar salad. Go back and do it again. That egg isn't coddled.
Your voice just changed.
Did it?
Yeah.
Well,
was that your mother's voice?
That was my mother's voice. And the other part of it was that there was a way in which I was kind of proud of her, because old ladies in restaurants get very short shrift.
And they don't tip very well.
Who knows if they do or they don't? The myth is that they don't. My guess is many old ladies, as an old lady myself these days, I tip very well.
So give me the time of day and you may be surprised.
And, you know, I also had a character who was a sad sack old lady,
yes.
Betty,
who you'd actually followed home on the bus.
Who I saw her on a bus and I stood up for her because she looked so tired. And she looked at me and said, oh, dearie, no one ever stands up for me. I feel invisible. And I thought, invisible? I'm trying to be invisible. I'm going to turn my... And so I followed her home and I saw that she literally was invisible. And becoming my mother, especially after being Betty, she was visible. She was very visible. And, you know, there is a kind of pride in her, you know, demanding to be seen. There's also something a little sad about somebody who needs to be seen in a restaurant, which is partly what prompted one of my books, which was called Not Becoming My Mother, which is really about my mother's life and about who is this generation of women who need to go to restaurants to be seen, and how grateful I am to be a woman who can be seen without becoming a real pain in a restaurant.
While we're talking about that, I'd like to just finish on this, because you went from being a food critic at these newspapers to being editor-in-chief at Gourmet magazine. And there was a code of ethics that you tried to impart to the people that work for you, that you also instilled within yourself, no matter what character you played, when you were reviewing food. Can you tell us about what that was?
You know, there are lots of ways of thinking about what a restaurant review is. I think criticism, good criticism, enhances the experience, I mean, whether it's art or books or theater or whatever. A good review should make the reader better prepared to experience whatever it is that you've reviewed. But the most important rule for any critic, I think, is do not review the restaurant, the book, the painting that you wish this person had done. Review what they are trying to do. Because if you do that, if you review the restaurant that a chef is attempting, you can review a very high-end restaurant and you can review a hot dog stand at the same standards. And I think one of the biggest mistakes that many critics make is that they insist on reviewing the restaurant they have in their head that this chef should be doing. And that's not fair.
Ruth Reichel, it's been an absolute pleasure, and I hope your second novel is as delicious as your first, this one published by Allen & Unwin in Australia, and thank you again for joining us on the program.
My pleasure, really.
New York food critic and author Ruth Reichel. And that's the show for this week. RN First Bite is produced by Maria Tickle. I'm Michael McKenzie, and talk to you soon.